Hello and welcome back to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on that zero emission future that we all hope for, and that will become particularly poignant any minute. Because folks, we've already done this once, and it kind of crashed and burned because we forgot to record it. Anyway, here we are back again, and Isabel gets a chance to rerun the last half an hour of her life again. And we get to do that with one of the wonderful members of the EV Cafe team, and that is the lovely John. This, John, welcome to you.
Well, greetings, Paul. How lovely to see you.
I know. It's just like we've just appeared and just seen each other. There we go. But anyway, even better, we have an innovator, a pioneer, and a collaborator. But with the emphasis, I think, on pioneer this week, the wonderful Isabel Sheldon. Isabel, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Real pleasure to be here. And I've heard that intro twice. Does that mean I have to send two invoices now?
Yes, probably. But Isabel, we missed off five letters in your introduction. Doctor and OBE. And we're going to come on to those things. And I'm sort of almost even more excited to come on to them for the second time, because I know the wonders that we're going to deliver to our listeners. So it's very, very exciting. So tell me, a doctor in what?
So it's a doctor of science in engineering and sustainability and battery technology. I didn't actually go to university and study a PhD, so this is an honorary doctorate. And in the post award ceremony dinner that we had, I did say to the university, I've got to work out how I can commute this into a Doctor of Science where I can put doctor in front of my name. And they went, oh, no, you already can do that. It's within our university rules to allow this. So you can call yourself doctor outside of the university environment. But also, you know, we consider your life's work as being your thesis. So you've certainly earned the recognition and earned the right to be able to use that in front of your name.
And this was obviously quite a I know that this is a recent thing, relatively. How did it feel, and what was the whole experience of the day?
It was the most wonderful experience. You know, they ask you as an honorary graduate to give a speech, and you have to provide something that's inspirational to the students. I probably focused on more honesty rather than doing a Tim Minchin, to be honest. So I was talking about, you know, life being hard work, and this isn't a golden ticket. This is something that gives you a step up in life, but you've got to really apply yourself. And also started talking about things like how life is a series of disappointments thrown together by the occasional pieces of good news, which is very typical if you've been involved in entrepreneurial life. But certainly to stand up in front of, I estimate, maybe 3,000 people in Lincoln Minster, that amazing cathedral up in Lincoln, was quite incredible. And to see all these students, I've never joined an event where there was so much happiness, because these students had got to the end of their university life and achieved their awards and their qualifications, which was absolutely wonderful.
It's fabulous to talk to a Dr. Sheldon. It's like Dr. Sheldon Cooper. Wonderful. Are you that kind of incredibly nerdy human being who finds it difficult to relate to others? Because I don't get that sense from you. Immediately there's a warmth, there's a smile, there's a connectedness. You're not a nerd, are you? You're a normal human being who is just brilliant at explaining stuff.
Well, yeah, I think probably where I have a bit of a skill is, because I didn't go into formal higher education, I've had to break things down for myself. So the majority of my knowledge in battery technology, and don't forget, when I started back in 2002, 2003, you couldn't go to university and understand this stuff. Mm. You know, we were writing the book as far as battery technology and electric vehicles was concerned. You know, I've been very much self-educated. I've had mentors. I'm not going to claim all the credit for building up my knowledge myself. So I've worked with some incredible people. But fundamentally, I have been self-educated or mentored through this. So for me to understand it, I've had to break it into its component parts and simplify it as much as possible and then build it back up into concepts. And I think when I talk to people and I explain technology, especially if I'm pitching for raising money for businesses or talking to other technologists who may not be specialists in this area, being able to put it across in fairly straightforward language has always been a benefit I've been able to bring to the table.
Were you a bright kid? Were you somebody at school who just was just brilliant and good at everything you did? And so this is a natural progression? Or have you been inspired just to learn about this thing?
Well, it's weird because I'm actually registered dyslexic. So that difference between your academic ability and your IQ is quite large with me. But even being dyslexic, I'd read the entirety of the Encyclopedia Britannica by the time I was about 12. So this hunger for information has always been within me. And I wake up with ideas every single morning and sometimes have to go and have a cold shower to wash them out of my head. Because like everybody else, you know, 95% of what you dream up is not realistic or practical. And it's the 5% you need to focus on. Yeah, I've always been interested in technology. I was always, you know, really fascinated by how things work. And that's how I got into electric vehicles. Fundamentally was creating a less polluting way of getting people to move around.
And it's quite phenomenal. I mean, I love, John and I are often easily baffled many times. And so when people can articulate their subject in the way that you can, it makes such a blooming difference. Because I think it was Einstein that said, you know, if you can't articulate your subject in the words of a six-year-old, you don't know it well enough. And you've managed to convince and help this six-year-old to understand a little bit more about battery technology, which is quite baffling. But one thing that I think you must have done it deliberately on your LinkedIn profile to drive the curious to ask the question of, it says, born at 324 ppm CO2. What does that mean and why is it important in your journey?
So I'm going to rewind to 1978 and my dad fixing his Mark III Cortina. And when he got the engine back together and started the car, I could see these exhaust gases coming out of the back. And being an RAF brat, I had some idea of how aircraft flew from my father. So I just said to him, the gas is coming out of the back. Is that what pushes the car along the road? Which is fairly advanced thinking for an 8-year-old. And he said, oh, no. I'll explain how an internal combustion engine works. You know, the four-stroke cycle, suck, squeeze, bang, blow. We're pulling in air, mixing fuel, compressing it, setting fire to it, creating a load of gases that we can't breathe. And by the way, don't go near the exhaust pipe because it's toxic. I was mortified that we were taking the air that we breathe, mixing it with fuel and creating gases that would harm us. And that was the point in time where I thought, you know, there has to be a better way. And hence the interest I had in the environment. And, you know, I'm not going to claim to be a tree hugger because we can't go and solve all the world's problems simultaneously. We have to choose our specialities and work on them. But going back to that PPM figure when I was born in 1969, looking at the PPM figure today, which is 418, shows that we've had quite a sizable increase in the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. But it's not just about CO2. It's about pollution at the local level. It's about the NOx that comes out of, you know, vehicles, vans and trucks and cars, and making sure that, you know, we live in a healthier environment than we have done in the past.
Yeah, and PPM is what exactly, just so our listeners know?
Parts per million.
Parts per million. And I think the NOx figure would be a very interesting figure, which is the sort of particulate matter, isn't it, that comes out the back from particularly diesel vehicles. So has that been a driver in your life as you've gone along? What is it that sort of really affects you around that air quality element?
Well, as I grew up, I was asthmatic, and so that put me in hospital quite a few times. And, you know, when you can't breathe, nothing else matters. I can absolutely assure people of that. As you're struggling for your next breath and in your head, I just need to be able to take the next breath and I can survive. that's a pretty fundamental existential threat to you. And as a small child, not being able to breathe, you know, and I went to on school trips to London, and in those days we still had lead in petrol, and you could smell the pollution in the atmosphere as soon as you got there. In the late 90s, I had my first trip to Japan, which was quite fundamental in my journey in electrification. You know, when I got back and I opened up the suitcase, the smell of the pollution from Tokyo was really quite remarkable.
Wow.
And I think we probably got desensitized to this in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and we didn't really realize how bad things were getting. And I think the pandemic really showed that air quality, you know, from, you know, and the detrimental effect we've had on air quality from industrialization and transportation really came to the fore when we saw those pictures in India of people being able to see the Himalayas 40 miles away for the first time in 50 years. I mean, that really does send a message that we live in quite a polluted environment.
None of us undertakes our journey through life without being inspired somewhere along the journey. Who inspired you to follow your path and instilled the values in you which you hold dear?
Bit of a strange one for me, really, because I tend to look for the white spaces where nobody else is working. So I think to emulate other people the whole time is to do yourself a bit of an injustice, because, you know, at the end of the day, we've got 7 billion people on this planet. We've got 7 billion different views of what the world looks like. And we're all really, really individual people. So, you know, you take some of the greats in history, Sir Isaac Newton, Winston Churchill, Einstein, some of the big business people in the world, Richard Branson, Elon Musk to a certain degree. Yeah, these are people that have shown that regardless of the challenges in life, you can still create a big difference. I mean, Sir Isaac Newton in particular is one that stands out for me, not just because I came from Lincolnshire, but because, you know, the things that he was trying to describe, the maths didn't exist to describe it. So he went and invented the mathematics too. I mean, how clever is that? I mean, that's a real smart clever cookie. But to look at those people and go, I want to be just like you, that's not me. I want to plow my own furrow in life and look for those white spaces and see if I can think of something that potentially nobody else has really thought about before. And that's probably where I found myself in the early 2000s when I was in Japan looking at the first generation Toyota Prius and thinking, that's not a bad effort. Maybe we can do a better job.
How hard has it been to be a woman who wants to plow her own furrow? Is it any different to being a man, in your opinion?
There are always challenges across the different genders. You know, and traditionally, you know, if you go back to, you know, when I was a child, 1970s and 1980s, you know, females' place in society was a very different place to where it is today. Society has moved on, thank God. Diversity and inclusion is really, really important because, you know, if we're going to put technology and products out into the marketplace, we have to represent the people that are going to use them. And men and women and everything in between, they're an important part of society, and they all have different desires and different needs and different wants. So we've got to make sure that we satisfy those in the most efficient way possible. Efficiency is really important to me.
Yeah.
It feels to me like it almost wouldn't matter. Well, it doesn't matter from your perspective. You have done exactly what you have set out to do, which is plow your own furrow and become extremely successful. You mentioned that sort of visit to Japan, the Toyota Prius. I think I can do a better job. How did that go? Because did you do a better job? Where did that end up?
Well, a bit of an unusual story. I was working as a tier one supplier into the automotive industry, and Japan was part of my territory along with the UK and Sweden, and certain parts of the industry in North America. And I was over there at the technical center talking to Toyota and you know, looking at that first generation Prius and thinking, I get the concept. I'd, you know, recently come across lithium ion battery technology and started to get interested in that. And then suddenly, you know, thinking about being able to offset fossil fuel use, because electric vehicles weren't really practical and possible back in the early 2000s. So taking a hybrid and turning it into a plug-in hybrid, adding a bigger battery and adding a charger so that you could add grid electricity and offset fuel fossil fuel usage within the vehicle seemed like a really good starting point. So that's where, you know, the original battery designs that I did in conjunction with a company called Energy CS in California, who did the battery management systems, you know, went and bought some Toyota Generation 2 Toyota Priuses and pulled them apart and figured out how they worked, designed and developed a battery that would interface with the hybrid system and try to offset fuel consumption. I think the record we had was on a fuel consumption challenge in London. We had the Metropolitan Police and various other vehicles entering. The Met Police managed about 67 miles to the gallon, and I think our official consumption was 423 miles to the gallon. Wow. So, yeah, we had some real good validation that, okay, under pretty strict competition conditions, we could achieve some really remarkable fuel consumption figures. And then just moved into electric vehicles. It seemed like a natural progression for me from there.
Fantastic. And batteries, you know, this whole movement forward, I mean, it just is quite outstanding thinking in my mind that you have kind of just kind of taken this concept. And I suppose, you know, you were already quite passionate about this because of the asthma and because of air quality and all of this was driving you forward. But, you know, no formal training, no science, no engineering, nothing, but you have really built a very solid career. I mean, well, you've been recognized because we spoke about Doctor earlier, and that was quite a moment. But talk to us about the OBE, because you've been recognized for all of this, all through this career of yours, and you got recognized with an OBE. How did that feel, and what was the journey of that? I mean, how did you get one? I don't know, because I haven't got one.
You don't qualify for one. You don't put yourself forwards for one. Somebody at some point decides that you deserve one and puts an application in for you. So not only has one person thought that, you know, what you've achieved in your career, or sometimes it can be charity and looking out for other people, or it could be services to television and acting and films. People have to decide that what you've done is worthy of recognition. But then they need to go out and find 10 to 15 other people to provide supporting letters to. So it's not just one person that thinks you deserve it. It's actually a collection of people coming together and saying, yeah, actually, I support this recommendation. But you don't actually get to know anything about it until the letter lands on the doorstep and you open it up and, you know, you see Honor Majesty's Service on the front and you think, oh God, you know, am I going to get extraordinary renditioned off to some dark site in God knows where, or do I have a big tax bill I can't pay? You have no idea. So you rip the letter open and really your life just comes to a grinding halt at that point and you think, my word, wasn't expecting this. And then you go through the process of accepting it. And you write a letter back and say, yes, I would like to accept. Some people say no, of course, because of the, you know, the relationship with the empire in the past. But, you know, those days are behind us. And then you go for an investiture. And I couldn't go to the palace because it was a pandemic. And, you know, the Queen would have been a significant risk if she got caught COVID in those days. So I went and received mine from the High Sheriff of Cambridge. And that's the point at which you get humbled, because they read out the dissertations during the investiture of what people had said about you, extracts. And you stand there in front of a load of people. And I think it's on YouTube somewhere. They had it video live streamed. But to get to hear what those people said about you and why they thought you deserved this was really quite humbling, and really takes down to your core.
Amazing.
You are heralded as somebody who has made a contribution and recognised as such. Do you ever have moments of self-doubt, of imposter syndrome, of that moment where you just think, am I a bit am I believing my own publicity? Does that ever happen to you?
Constantly. I've had imposter syndrome my entire life. You know, when you listen to corporate presentations and you can hear people in the background going, they believe their own PowerPoint slides. Well, that's what I feel my life has been. Yeah, I wake up every morning with an idea. I have to discount 95% of them. I carry some of them forward. And sometimes you do think you are just kidding yourself. Nobody else is going to buy into this. Nobody else is going to support this. But, you know, you look for those white spaces where other people aren't working and other people aren't putting the thinking in. And occasionally you have an idea that carries forwards. And, you know, electrification was one of those for me, batteries in vehicles. I mean, people told me back in the early days, never going to happen. You know, the oil industry would petition against it. They'll never sell. People won't buy them. They don't go far enough. They cost too much money. I've heard all these arguments for 22 years now, and I still get dismayed with the myths that are out there as far as electrified transportation is concerned. We need to be a lot stronger in pushing back against that kind of stuff, because the majority of it is absolutely rubbish. I understand I'm talking about it from the perspective of a career that's served me well, but fundamentally, efficiency, as I mentioned earlier on, is really, really important. And direct electrification is probably the only way to move people around without creating environmental problems.
What are you most proud of having delivered, Isabel? You know, obviously, you've got your professional achievements and you have these recognitions, these awards and honours. What is it that you hold dearest as having achieved?
I would have to say my children, to be honest. You know, I have a daughter and a son. My daughter's a paramedic, and she's done really, really well in her studies and obviously saves lives, which is absolutely incredible. It's great to be the parent of somebody that does that. And my son works in aerospace engines, so you know, works for Rolls-Royce. So you've got somebody there who's involved in looking at technology that, you know, at some point in the future will reduce the environmental impacts of aviation. So certainly my two children are my absolute pride and joy, and probably the things that I'm most proud of. But, you know, family is really, really important. And I'm one of four in my family, four children in my family, and maintain, you know, really good relationships with, very close relationships with two of my sisters. And I think whenever we get together, how proud I am to be part of that family. So that's very much something that's not part of my career. And then it's something that's very personal and very meaningful to me.
That's fantastic. And I kind of go, I'm going to go with the yang to the yin or the yin to the yang, because for every bright moment in life, there are those real tough moments that, I mean, you strike me as a really solid individual. One that kind of, you talked about ploughing your own furrow. You've had asthma as a kid, and you've had those difficult moments going to hospital, things like that. Talk to us about, because I think your advice to students, life is difficult, get used to the disappointments, but there will be successes in there. So it strikes me that you've had those difficult moments, those disappointments, not just in your working career, just in the same way that you've talked about pride in your children and your family. It's outside of our career. Talk to me about a challenging time that took you close to your limit and how you came out of it and what that taught you.
Well, there's quite a few of them. And, you know, I always believe that people that haven't experienced failures haven't really tried. You've got to have the failures in life to appreciate the successes. So British Folk was a pretty hard one for me. You know, although I wasn't directly responsible for, you know, not being able to fully raise the money and get the funding into the business, there were, you know, internal reasons why that was happening. There are external reasons that were happening, you know, in the general economy, and in particular with the UK government at that particular point in time, you know, the mini budget, pretty much quashed a 200 million ticket into BV, which was the final death knell. So that was pretty hard. But, you know, the ending of my first business, the Amberjack Projects business I set up, I ran it for 10 years. And, you know, that was where we did the original work in battery technology adapted for vehicles. You know, there was probably a handful of people around the world that were writing the book in those days, because you couldn't go on the internet and discover how to do this. We had to do it by trial and error. And, you know, we came into a massive global recession at the end of the 2000s. And that R&D money for developing alternative fueled vehicles pretty much dried up. And so we had to close the business. And, you know, when you have to think about making people redundant and throwing them out of work and closing the business and to go on and try and do something else in life, sometimes you feel as if you've got this massive, great big black hole in front of you and you can't see around it, you can't see over it. All you can see is the black hole opening up in front of you. And I think going through that experience taught me a lot about resilience, in that even when things do go wrong, there is light at the end of the tunnel, there is life afterwards. And you have to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and march forwards. And if you have strength in your convictions, like I do with electrification of transport, and you have the resilience to be able to stand by them, then long term, yeah, you do have a bright future in front of you. So resilience is the most important thing in life, in my view.
And it's only learned through difficult times.
Correct.
I mean, British Volt was I did notice that on your CV, as it were, and it must have felt really, really difficult, because you know, so many of us all were wrapped up in that. We've spoken to Ben Kilby, of course, who was on this podcast and was the chief. What was he? It was PR anyway. I've forgotten what his actual title was, but you know, and. It was something that was going to be great for Britain. It was something that was going to be great for the industry. There was a lot of tech wrapped up in it, sort of some of the side gigs around the development and stuff like that. What do you think we can carry forward from that? Because like we've said, even out of failures, we can still carry forward a lot of really great stuff. I mean, is the UK ready for a British Volt, a battery technology, because we are pretty innovative over here in the UK, aren't we?
Well, we are, and that was one of the great disappointments through, you know, probably the second half of that company, was that we brought together some of the brightest minds in the industry, you know, longest experience, brightest minds, people who knew exactly what they were doing, people that had done it before. And if you picked up the Financial Times or the Mail or the Guardian, and you read about no track record, haven't got a product, haven't got a customer, you know, all these negative things that were being written about us that were just simply not true. And after British Volt came to an end, go and have a look at LinkedIn of the people that worked at British Volt, and go and look at the companies they work for now. They're working for Agritas, they're working for Northvolt, they're working for ACC, they're working for some of the startups in Saudi Arabia. These people were snapped up, because they are so good. They were so incredibly good. And we brought them all together in one company. And we had this amazing pool of talent. And, you know, we were developing technology inside 2 years. It normally takes 4 to 5. So just a real indication of how quickly we were doing this. We weren't, you know, rewriting the fundamentals. We were just doing it in a smarter way. So coming to the end of that was hard. I think that the UK lost a real innovation there. It was an independent company. It wasn't backed by one of the major car companies in the same way that Envision AESC was. You know, that was a joint venture between NEC and Nissan, got spun out into an independent company, but was still grown by that automotive outfit in the first place. Agritas has come along. It's part of Tata. Of course, they're going to be supplying Jaguar Land Rover. So you've got these big facilities that are, you know, fundamentally sponsored by the automotive OEMs that need those battery technologies. I think where we are with the UK is the independent battery manufacturing operation is not going to be possible moving forwards. because it's, you know, we've sent a big message with the failure of British Vault. You know, if you can't get that backing from the automotive industry right from the word go, then you're just not going to be able to raise the funding to build these big expensive facilities. And I think Northvolt's going through a very, very similar thing at the moment. You know, raised a lot of money, haven't quite delivered. They're feeling the pain of that. We all hope that they're successful and can turn that around. But certainly they're going through a similar kind of difficult period that we did at British Vault a couple of years ago now. So my heart goes out to all the people that have put so much work and effort into that organization, because they deserve to succeed. And they were the first one, the first independent one in Europe.
Yeah.
You spoke about the media, Isabel, and you quoted some titles. yes. And they are responsible, in my opinion, for a great deal of the ills in this industry, by just promoting falsehoods, lies, call them what you will. And one of those is around rare earth resources and the impact that creating batteries has on our environment. Can you give us your explanation of how you justify taking lithium, cobalt, and turning it into batteries and its environmental impact, so that anybody who's listening to this who thinks, oh, well, battery electric vehicles are just as harmful as turning out an internal combustion engine vehicle, might say, oh, I was wrong about that.
Well, interestingly, there aren't any rare earth materials that go into battery technology. You know, rare earths are the magnets. Rare earths are the specialist metals. So, you know, nickel, cobalt, aluminium, iron, lithium, these are rare earths.
Not rare.
Exactly. You know, they are actually quite abundant. I mean, go back 5 years, people were talking about there not being enough of lithium in the world to power this electrification globally moving forwards. We've now got an abundance of lithium and the price is on the floor. So, you know, economics tends to have a way of proving people wrong on these kinds of things. But if you look at the fundamentals, if you look at the resources that need to go into fossil fuels versus the minerals that we turn through the midstream into the battery materials that go into making the cells that go into the cars, it's like an order of magnitude different. If you look at the size of the fossil fuel industry and how much resources they put in place to drill this stuff out of the ground, refine it, ship it around, and put it through your vehicle, and that's one use. Single use. Once it's burnt, it's gone. You can't do anything about it. And then compare that with the order of magnitude less mining that needs to go in and the pollution that's created from that to create the minerals that go into the batteries that will be recycled at some point in the future and will be fed back into the system. There is just no comparison. And, you know, you can... 99% of statistics are made up on the spot. It's a joke I always use about it. You know, people can pick up on a piece of information and that tiny edge case that they see that may potentially disprove the theory, they use as the main thesis for making their arguments moving forwards. And every report that I've ever read that's been peer-reviewed and has got through to, you know, the credibility of being published and not retracted, shown that the pollution from digging the stuff out of the ground and putting it through a battery facility, which does exist, we can't ignore it. These things aren't zero emissions. They're zero emission at the tailpipe, and that's an important differentiation. Every report has said this is significantly lower environmental impact than continuously burning all this fuel, all these fossil fuels, in the various different ways we do around the world and creating all this environmental carnage. People really need to read more, in my view. In particular, the journalists. And some of those journalists are now blocked on my phone because my experience from them has just been so poor. Yeah. I won't talk to them again.
It's so challenging, isn't it? We all look for a headline, don't we, I think? We want to make something, you know, and I talk to lots of people and you know, spoke to, you know, going through difficult times and startups and things like that. And sometimes you just need to just take a chill pill and listen more than you speak. And it's an incredibly challenging time in that respect, because we want people just to kind of understand efficiency is critical and zero emission at the tailpipe is critical. And we need to just kind of work our way towards net zero. Net zero doesn't happen. And we get angry, don't we? Because we can't have the perfect alternative, but we can have a better alternative. And I think people are caught up in saying, well, if you can't do perfect, don't bother doing it at all. But we need to keep improving, you know, don't we? Isn't it a continuous improvement rather than just a...
Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, energy density since I started in the battery industry has pretty much doubled. So we can go twice as far on the charge than we could in the mid-2000s. The vast majority of people that have a really sort of allergic reaction to electrification or electric vehicles have never actually driven one. You know, it's the armchair reaction. Expertise that comes into play. and I get tired and tired of hearing things like, they don't go far enough. I heard that in 2005, and maybe it was true. 2024, I don't think it is. You know, how many miles do you drive each day? I like to ask, and people go 30. Well, you don't need an electric vehicle more than 120 miles range, do you really, fundamentally? And you can go and buy one that's 350, 400 miles now. And I think that's going to be the big turning point in the industry, is when, you know, this first generation of users start to, when they come to buy their second car and they're going into the showroom, and, you know, the first time they demanded 300 miles, they look at what they've actually done over the last 3 or 4 years and think, actually, I don't need 300 miles. I'll take a lower price car because the battery's smaller, and 175, 200 miles is good enough for 99% of my journeys. I think that's when we're going to start seeing a real uptick in adoption rates, when people start to match the reality of what they do every day with the practical ability within the vehicles that they go out and buy in the showrooms. And I don't think we're going to have to wait long for that to happen. I really don't.
No. Well, it's a good job that there's something like the EV Cafe there to bring all of these things to life with the wonderful people that we get on our Takeaway podcast and on the news and on the webinars. Oh, I just think it's perfectly timed. Anyway, now, Isabel, what do you like to do for fun? Now, so for those of you watching, you might already have an idea of what Isabel might like to do for fun. Helpfully, for those of you listening, she has just twanged something on her wall. So, Isabel, tell us a little bit about what you like to do for fun.
I really, really enjoy spending time with family. It's probably my most favourite thing. I really enjoy spending time in the south of France, and I like to drive to the south of France if I can, especially in electric vehicles, so my holidays are as pollution-free as possible. Although I said I wasn't a tree hugger earlier on, there's still a little thing in the back of my mind that said, you know, try and make it as environmentally friendly, whatever you do moving forwards. And, you know, I just love my family. I love my dog. I really love cooking. I absolutely adore cooking. I'm not very good at it. I put food in front of people and they go, what is it? But it's probably the way I de-stress more than anything else. And I've talked to people in the past who have said, you know, when I was commuting to Coventry and back from Cambridge every day, or Cambridgeshire every day, oh, how do you get on with cooking in the evening? Well, I know I set to and cook in the evening. And it's like, well, don't you find that stressful? No, it's the way I de-stress. It's the way I unload. So I really, really enjoy cooking. And I've started to collect quite a lot of equipment in the kitchen to enable me to do more strange and weird and wonderful stuff that people question.
So I feel cheated now, because you've got lots of guitars hanging behind you, for those of you that haven't done the maths yet on either the fact that there's guitars in the background or the twang. So they're nothing to do with you then, though?
No, they all are my guitars. I took lessons for about 15 years. I'm not very good, a bit like my cooking. something I enjoy doing for the stress relief, but ask me to go up on stage and twang a guitar and sing into a microphone and I'm off.
Well, we were thinking of inviting you to Carfest next year, to both talk and entertain us. But I think we'll just stick with talking then on the basis of that conversation.
Right. Probably very wise.
So,
don't ask me to talk either.
So my final question, Isabel, is going to be around the future. So you've done a lot. You've achieved a great deal. You've got wonderful kids and a good life. And you drive to the south of France. You play guitar. You cook food that is difficult to describe. What next?
More digest, possibly.
Not for me to say yet. However, what is left to do? What have you got going on in your head that you can focus on and bring your talents to bear to further the cause, to do something well and for the benefit of mankind? What's going to happen next?
Well, it all starts with technology and economics. You know, if the economics don't work, don't even start with the technology. And if the technology mm-hmm. doesn't obey the laws of physics, then you're off to a bit of a non-starter. I think the thing for me, the big challenge, is all of the major componentry for this electrification transition is centered in a certain area of the world. And I think that generates a bit of an allergic reaction sometimes. I think China has done a wonderful job. I really do. Mm. Really smart, innovative, industrious approach to this challenge that the world has in front of us. But we can't continue to rely on China. There are lots of reasons for that. And quite a few geopolitical ones that I won't get involved in because it's not my bag. But it's moving those technologies over to the West to make sure that we have gross domestic product benefit for our economies from this green transition. You know, supplying jobs, building facilities, giving employment, making sure that, you know, there isn't too much leverage over the supply chains that we've got a risk of at the moment. So I think really transitioning these technologies back to the West, and I say back to the West because originally all of this technology was generated in the West and got industrialized in the Far East. So we know how to do this. We've just got really, really lazy. Our capital markets have been focused around software. You know, give a software company £2.35 and you get 12 billion back in 5 years. We've got too lazy about the kind of risk appetite that we've got. And we've got to adjust our attitude towards that moving forwards because, you know, we can't just sell insurance and financial products to each other. We actually have to get back to making things and generating national income. And that growth in national income provides taxation, which helps us run our economies. And it generally comes from making stuff in factories. So my mission from this point onwards is to get the cathode materials that I think the electrification industry needs and have them manufactured in the West. Not go back and reinvent the wheel, because if you're waiting for the next Carlos Fandango development, you end up waiting for a long time. But understanding how areas like China have really industrialized this moving forwards and how they've done that in the past and how moving forwards we can adapt those manufacturing techniques and processes so we can get them permitted in the West, but we can also do things at a competitive price compared to our Chinese colleagues and friends, because we need to share the benefit of this more widely than is being done at the moment.
Agreed. Carlos Fandango, thank you for that. That's like an earworm now. I'll have that. I haven't heard that for many, many, many moons, but it will be stuck there forever. Thanks.
Oh, it just describes, you know, the attitude to battery technology in the West is we need to be 4 steps ahead of everybody else. But those 4 steps ahead are always 10 years in the future, so we end up doing nothing. Yeah. No, actually, technology is good enough today. Let's adopt it. Let's figure out how we can do that competitively in the West. And that's my mission for the next 10 years.
Brilliant. Well, we support you. Absolutely.
And it's so clearly articulated. Isabel, I'm just so blown away with your clarity of thinking across multi-disciplines and your picture of the world that you've just kind of brought it together. And it seems that your thinking is not only very laser focused on battery, but it also takes in all of the other elements that are going on in the ether that surround us, the geopolitical, the technology, the GDP, you know, all of these elements that you bring together. So with that in mind, we'd like to do a little tradition on the EV Cafe Takeaway podcast and hand somebody a magic wand. You only get one wish, but we'll hand you a magic wand and let you make something change that will fundamentally make your mission easier going forward for the next 10 years. You know, it can be anything. There you go. It's in your hand now. How would you wish to wave said wand and cast your spell or whatever you want to do?
I think I would wave it in the direction of the climate skeptics. And the reason for that is you hear a lot of pushback against, you know, green progress and decarbonisation moving forward. Just take a look out of the window, just look at the weather that you're experiencing every day of the week, and I think you get a really good understanding that things are changing, and things are changing for the worse. So if I could take away the scepticism over something that to me is obvious, and take away the rubbish that I read in the press about things like electric vehicles or heat pumps or some of the other technologies that are really going to help us improve our environment moving forward. That's what I would wave every single time.
Amazing. And it's a great way to finish what has been a very insightful, really interesting chat. And as well, we would love to invite you to Carfest next year, where we're going to be talking to people. We're building up a network of people that can come and help everybody understand, because this is one of the things that we at the EV Cafe love to do, is to get out there. And we had such a good time at Carfest. We also, you know, a couple of other shows that we're going to be doing next year, but Carfest was one where we got to speak to people that are in this ether of either being climate skeptic or misunderstanding. I think, you know, nobody was out there really trying to peddle disinformation, but they were the subject of disinformation. They were the misguided, let's call them that. And I think that is the challenge. We want to help those, to just help them make informed decisions based on facts and figures rather than the misinformation. So I won't hold you to it, but we'd love for you to come to Carfest next year. So it's the bank holiday weekend of August. So please, can you put it in your diary if you'd like? You get a free ticket.
I would be delighted to come along. I really would. So thank you for that invite.
Yay! You might have to bring a guitar. So I think you know Roger Atkins. He's bringing his harmonica, but he also plays the guitar. So, you know, we want some musicians as well. So bring a guitar along. We won't make you use it in anger, but we might have some fun with it.
I can just bash Roger over the head with it. So
Listen, everybody, Isabel has been an absolute blast, hasn't she? Please do share this incredible journey. And I think we've only really scratched the surface, which is a shame. But I'm sure we'll get many more opportunities to talk to Isabel. Isabel, congratulations on your career and one so widely recognised, both with the doctorate and the OBE, but also just the things that you've achieved through your career that has significantly moved us forward on the battery side of things. You've gone and done, and now you're talking about it. And that is such a laudable thing to have, you know, tried and failed on occasions, you know, but really moved the needle forward and learned from all of the experiences that you've had. Very, very impressed, and I'm very grateful for the little girl that learned a lesson on combustion at the tender years of 8 and has spent the rest of her life kind of trying to turn things backwards so that we can get that CO2 down from below to below the date that you started out life at 324. So thank you. Thank you so much. And it just leaves me to point everybody in the direction of the EV Cafe webpage, where you can listen to a back catalogue of over 80 podcasts at this point in our existence, and also our LinkedIn page. But also check us out on Instagram and YouTube too. Lots of wonderful places to digest the madness that is the EV Cafe, with a whole lot of good, helpful facts thrown in. Isabel, thank you. John, good to have you here as always. Thank you. Until next time, everybody, have a great day.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for the invite. Thank you.
Bless you.